Hello and welcome to AutoLine This Week. I'm John McElroy, standing in front of the world headquarters of the Ford Motor Company, because in just a moment, we're going to take you inside and talk to three experts about the future and how we all fit into it.
Here is your host, John McElroy.
As I said, we're going to be talking about the future, but not just with cars. We'll be looking at a variety of topics, including design, fashion, societal trends. And I've got three great experts to be talking about that today, including Cheryl Connolly, who looks at all global trends in futuring for the Ford Motor Company. Gadi Amit, the president of New Deal Design, and you're going to be very interested in some of the things that he's designed. Also joining us are John Gersema, the executive chairman of BAV Consulting, which I understand is part of Burson Marsteller as well.
That's correct.
Very good. So let's get into it. You know, who knows where this conversation's going to go? Let's start out talking about big trends in transportation, or let's call it mobility, because I think that's a better way of doing it. Cheryl, why don't I talk with you to start with, in that automakers are facing government regulations all around the world to boost fuel economy, cut CO2, or really greenhouse gas emissions. They're coming out with hybrids and plug-ins, battery electric cars, now fuel cell cars are hitting the market, but they haven't really caught on. Even in the United States, the largest market in the world for these kinds of vehicles, they're like 3% of sales. How do you think we're going to resolve this? How is the auto industry going to resolve trying to meet these government regulations when the public just does not seem to be on board yet?
Well, I think it's all about how you frame the question, because I am not sure it's the automotive industry that will resolve that question ultimately. And as the in-house futurist for Ford, my job is to kind of make sure that we're looking outside of our industry. We're looking at global shifts, societal, technological, economic, environmental, and political arenas. We can't predict the future, but we can certainly try to prepare ourselves so that we learn to expect the unexpected. And Ford's strategy in that regard specifically has to surrender to the idea that we don't know. We don't know and we can't know, so we have these parallel paths of innovation where we're trying to improve, you know, fuel cells, hybrid, pure electric. But we also can do amazing things on just your traditional gas engine. So with the EcoBoost, it's one of our most successful and popular engines on the marketplace. And so you look at famous innovators like Clay Christensen, who talk about that the innovation in these things are maybe our best path. Disruptive innovation could be wonderful, but there also could be seismic change from incremental innovation. So we're trying to cover all of our bets.
Gadi, what role does design play in this? I mean, here you're and we should let the audience know you've designed the Fitbit, which has launched a revolution in personal health and exercise. Is it design that's going to do this?
And just to add to that, I designed a few years ago a system with a company called Better Place that was trying to deploy infrastructure for electric cars. I think design has a major role in creating new advanced technologies more appealing and more readily, say, connecting with the average consumer. I think typically technologies that are right at the cutting edge are not the most communicative, not the most enjoyable, and so on. And if you take a company that does it correctly, let's say like Tesla, they put the whole package together, it's something different. It becomes, it is breaking through some barriers and making people gravitate towards the product rather than being convinced or pushed towards the product, let's say by regulation and so on. So I'm a great believer in a consumer open market where design has a major role to make these more ecologically friendly vehicles more appealing.
What would crack the code to do that? I mean, from your vantage point, not as an automotive designer, as an outsider.
So two things in my opinion. One is highly complex technical topic, which is range anxiety. How do you deal with that? But another is something that people don't pay attention to. It's not electric car any longer. Actually, even our gas cars are not gas cars. It's our digital environments. We actually text, which we don't like to admit. We have entertainment system. Mm-hmm. We have a navigation system and so on. And people look at that as an extension of their living room in a sense of having a lot of these enjoyable digital gadgets, if you wish, around them. And I think there is a way that we could take that digital brilliance and weave it into the car, create opportunities for people to lean back a little bit and enjoy the digital experience, leaving the car to drive a few miles. You know, it's still, you know, traffic jam, and you don't want to deal much with driving. And then later, in the, let's say, around the corner when it's open road, you could actually kick into your driver mode and enjoy the car. So I think digital technology within the car should really leap forward and allow people to enjoy digital experience rather than being just mere drivers.
I think, Gotti, to build on that point, getting millennials, that's their life, yeah. right? That's yeah. how they think. And if you think about their definition of exploration today, yeah. our definition of exploration would have just been physical transportation. Yeah. Their definition is sort of digital freedom and digital expression. And so the merging yeah. of those two worlds, I think, is incredibly important.
Yeah, and I think just to add to that, the whole topic of ownership of a car is being transformed now. Mm-hmm. And I know that, for instance, a lot of my designers live in San Francisco and they prefer not to own a car, but they take a car by zip car for 2 hours, or they use Uber and so on. So all these combinations are going to be out there. I actually think that we'll have a hybrid future rather than mm-hmm. In the sense that we'll have multiple models and people will hop between these models as they wish. So that's actually a very interesting and, I think, beautiful future.
Mm-hmm. It is. And the millennials are a really great example because, you know, they're the youngest members of the consuming market right now. And so their preferences can kind of give us a cue as to what we might see in the future. And when we look at yep. the difference between millennials and baby boomers, their attitudes towards a vehicle, car ownership, or even getting your driver's license are fundamentally different. Yep. So today in the U.S., 7 out of 10 16-year-olds do not have their driver's license. And the numbers are down not just for 16-year-olds, but 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds, yep. and 19-year-olds. And to Gotti's point, the miles driven by the people 21 to 30 years of age, also down. So as an automotive manufacturer, we have to ask ourselves, what are the societal influences that are changing? So when some of us were coming of age, if you were a baby boomer, for instance, you got your first car, it was a rite of passage. Yeah. It was what we like to say, the gateway purchase into adulthood. Yeah. Now our kids, any one of our kids would argue that their first cell phone was their gateway yeah. purchase into adulthood. And so this convergence of technology yeah. and constant connectivity are things that are changing. What mobility means.
It is. But John, I want to ask you, there's, of course, global variations in looking at all this kind of thing. So in the United States, as Cheryl just points out, we're seeing fewer and fewer teenagers getting their driver's license. Yeah. Meanwhile, in China, car sales are going crazy.
Sure.
There still is that rite of passage that's taking place there.
Sure.
How do you see this evolving on a global basis, this development?
Yeah, and I think, John, to be a marketer, you've got to obviously look at the culture and the context. And, you know, in China, for example, in our data and BAV, we see young Chinese millennials, their aspirations are not their parents, their aspirations are other global millennials around the world. So they feel far more connected to kids their age in other countries. So I think you've got to look at those contexts. I think Cheryl raises a really important point about not only technology and the way that they're thinking, but also we've got economic constraints. You're looking at student loan challenges here, you know, in the U.S. and in other parts of the world, different levels of disposable income, and all these, I think, have a factor to play. You figure out about how to get people to drive and to own a car. But I will go back to what Guy said. It was so interesting. I think it's so important to think about the fact that there could be multiple models of ownership. You know, I was at a conference, South by Southwest, and Brian Chesky was there, and he raised a great point. He talked about the average length of a power tool, right? So if you bought a power tool today, what's the average length that that's been used? Take a guess.
Once.
Right. Total time.
It's only been once.
14 minutes.
14
right?
minutes. Oh, my gosh.
So then that becomes a question.
Of course, it's been in the garage for 20 years.
Right. So then it becomes a question of utility. And yet at the same time, you've got, you know, Airbnb and One Fine Stay and these other companies like Neighbor Goods in San Francisco that are helping you take your purchases and make them become assets in the sense that they continue to sort of, you know, derive revenue for you. So I think it is a multiple sort of consumer producer model that's emerging.
And I think that the reason why those, that you have to look underneath why those things are popular, and part of it is a financial constraint, right? So
you've got
young people, those millennials who were promised the world and an oyster, you know, and the job market hasn't received them the way that they had hoped or anticipated. But they do have an appetite for the finer things. And so one way they can still partake in that is to rent, to borrow, to share, to collaboratively consume. But even if finances aren't what holding you back, there are lots of people that say ownership is a lot of responsibility. It means insuring, maintaining, storing. And then beneath all of that, it happens to be a really sustainable solution.
But just to peg into that notion, if we talked about these millennials as people who have a complete digital culture, they're immersed with that. That's their experience. What I think is not there is that the experience of driving didn't become digital. So if I'm renting a car, it takes me a long time until I figure out how to get my phone to get the music through the new car and so on. So what will need to happen, I think, is some level of openness by the car companies to allow or to embrace, if you wish, this digital culture around it and open up so people could have a meaningful hour or two of a rental car or a zip car, and then they see that they could, you know, enjoy it through their digital way of life, and then maybe the next one will be a weekend. And so on. So I think there is some kind of a separation of experiences. My generation experienced things more mechanically. Maybe my daughters are completely immersed in the digital culture, and we need to somehow bridge that.
Gani, we're right around the corner. We're going to see autonomous cars, cars that can drive themselves. Will that answer the question that you're, or the issue that you're addressing?
I've been asked a few times about it. I'm actually, my view is complex. There are definitely some functions. For instance, people who are disabled or, you know, delivering packages and so on, that autonomous cars will be amazing to use. At the same time, I think for a lot of people, including millennials, the experience of driving fast in an open road and enjoying it is still there. We're still physical animals. There's still visceral connection to what we do, to the motion and to emotions that come with that. Now, later, around the corner, you drove and you got stuck in a traffic jam. Over there, you probably want to push a button and say, take me home. So we will have some, again, a hybrid reality in which multiple use modes are going to be used, sometimes in a vertical way, let's say to deliver packages, but sometimes my ideal car is a car that I drive for fun, and then when I'm getting stuck in traffic, it basically does all that and I could do other things.
I think that the joy of driving is still one of our pillars within Ford. But the reality is globally, and I think it's Frost and Sullivan that put this quote together, something to the extent that the average speed traveled worldwide is about 25 miles per hour. And so there are pockets not evenly distributed. So there, you know, here in the U.S. there's still lots of opportunities to have that pedal to the metal, the wind in your hair, the open roads ahead. And that is part of the romantic view of car ownership. But for other parts, that's not a reality. And we've heard Bill Ford, our chairman, talk about his fear. What if we continue to add more vehicles to the road? That may not be an ideal solution if it creates global gridlock.
That and the dynamic of urbanization, you know.
Sure.
Sammy Hagar back in my day had this famous song, I Can't Drive 55, and I think that's pretty much the norm now in New York and in Singapore and other places.
John, you look at things all over. As Cheryl points out, I think there's roughly a billion cars on planet Earth right now. Some projections would suggest in a couple of decades we might double that, 2 billion cars.
Yeah.
It ties right in with population growth. We're at, what, 6 billion now, headed to 9? What's that going to do to maybe not just mobility, but society in general?
Well, it's going to put all kinds of stress on our resources. I'm, you know, as a global traveler, business person like Cheryl and I'm so jet-lagged. So what I think about this time today is that there's this huge shift, and I've gone back and, like, as a global traveler, looked at spending time in Beijing in the 90s and in Vietnam and the early 2000s, and you just literally saw this dramatic shift, right? Yeah. Going from bicycles to, you know, motorbikes to cars. So it's a tremendous stress that's going to be put on our infrastructure.
Do you see it that way, Gadi?
I totally agree, but I do think that a lot of the solutions are within the design domain. I think we used to have old Ford trucks that are still out there. People will fix them. Today, you cannot fix a car. You need, you know, you need a whole shop with computers and so on. And the same thing I say to the industry I'm familiar with, let's say the mobile phone industry, being able to repair and hold to an object, let's say 5, 7, 10 years, rather than discarding it after 2 or 3 years, will solve that problem.
Basically, you see that happening instead of this disposable throwaway electronic?
I see the yearn for that. I know a lot of the designers in my studio bought small, clunky motorcycles. And I asked them why. And they said, because I can fix them. Mm-hmm. And I like to get my hands dirty with grease, and I like to fix them. And I could still control it. And people like that. So building all these human qualities, people still want to be able to maintain the same object, that they have a lot of embedded memories. They just want to maintain it longer. And I think we should, as design community, as in the industries, I'm talking both the mobile industry and the car industry, allow cars and any object to live longer, be serviced better, maybe change more engines, change digital brain, whatever. This is really a crucial challenge for the designers around the world, and I think we can do it.
Well, you know, the average car in the U.S. today is 11 and a half years. Mm-hmm. So they've already achieved that. But to your point, so much of the technology in those older cars is outdated.
Yeah.
Even in luxury cars, it's outdated, and there's no easy way to upgrade it.
Yeah, try to upgrade a Bluetooth software in one of the modern cars. I'm not talking about something from the 70s. No. It's impossible.
Well, one of the things that actually Ford is trying to address, because you do have this thing, you have a durable good, a car that's a decade old, you got a cell phone that's a couple months old, and you know what's going to change. And so we actually do have this open architecture to try to make sure that we can stay abreast of that. And we've engaged in many more strategic partnerships, so we're not just looking at what other auto manufacturers are doing. We want to know what other consumer electronics providers are doing. So we have a program called OpenXC where we have taken proprietary systems and made them open source so that we can tap into the minds of these two and have them collaborate and make the vehicle experience better. And I guess fundamentally then you start to say, you know, companies like Ford don't see themselves as just selling vehicles, but we're selling mobility in all shapes, sizes, and colors.
I think that also taps into the mindsets we were discussing earlier of the next generation car buyer, right? They're thinking in terms of apps that are buggy. You know, my daughter said to me, well, this app is a little buggy. You know, they got to work it out. Well, they understand there's versions of 2.1, 2.2, and everything. Yeah. And so this is a far more organic process, I believe.
Yeah, and I think the good news is that we are now suddenly aware of it. There is a big word called interoperability between, you know, software and hardware components, and in cars you always feel it. You know, there is one part that is still harkening back on technology that was tried and true for the last 30, 40 years, and then there is a new Bluetooth thingy that is buggy and so on. And that is part of maintaining the life of a car or for any object, is, again, making sure that it's fully functional and enjoyable. Very important. I mean, I actually want to chime in here. I am not sure the term mobility is giving us enough of these human emotional values. It's a very utilitarian economics. I mean, you know, professors of economics will use it. I think to some degree we need to find, and I understand why it's used, we need to find a new vernacular that will embed the emotional side of the experience of new quote-unquote mobility with the utility of it.
I completely agree. And I think there's an irony that, you know, we talk about our mobile phone and, you know, but when we talk about that mobility, we're not talking about the same mobility in terms of planes, trains, automobiles. Yeah. But at some point, there is in the abstract this intersection.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it actually takes me to a different point that, you know, fundamentally, one of the questions that Ford is trying to answer is, what is the future of mobility? And I often say as a futurist that question can't be answered until you figure out things like, what's the future of work? You know, how many people will work from home? Where will there be virtual employment? And you can't answer that question until you understand the future of education. And the future of education will be about government stability and economic inputs. You know, so you start to see just how complex and holistic tackling these problems become.
And yet, just to peg to that, to me, the anchor is the human being. We still want to interact. So a lot of the experiment with remote workers didn't really deliver. And we've seen, for instance, Yahoo actually called everyone in back. We are interacting now. We're enjoying it. There's nothing that technology could actually deliver on that. And with that said, what I want to say is we should be more mature with expectations from technology. Technology cannot solve education. Technology cannot solve issues with workplace and so on. So we will still be traveling to meet people because we humans, we are a social animal. We want to interact with people and enjoy it. The question is, how are we going to do that? How frequently are we going to do that? What's going to be the journey like?
And we actually try to track this. One of the trends that we published in our 2014 trend book was this battle between the fear of missing out, which is, you know, created, the modern take on that is that constant connectivity. But it's up against this idea about the joy of missing out. How do you make sure that you live in the present, that you have the fulfillment of having undivided attention towards a single activity, a single conversation. Yep. It's becoming harder and harder, but I think as it becomes more harder, the more valued it gets recognized and the more people struggle to make sure it becomes a reality or part of their daily experience. It fundamentally comes back down to human connection.
We had two data points on that, Cheryl, from our research. This was fielded last week, but one of them we thought was kind of interesting. Survey of just of Americans, quantitative survey in our data, 19% of people, only 19% felt that they were really good at living in the moment. So I think that there's this sort of technology dwarf thing that's happening too on top of everyone with the way that they think and live.
I just want to second that. I think one of the biggest challenges I have in the day-to-day communication with clients, and some of them are the largest tech companies, is to push back against this massive wall of data that is attacking you as a human being, and you want to basically sift through the clutter and get only the relevant one and be able to be in the zone and actually enjoy it rather than being bombarded or chased by that. And that's a huge challenge for the tech business. And to some degree, it reflects on what happens now in cars because people text while driving and they will continue to text no matter what we'll do because this is part of their experience. So we need to change that experience to allow them to enjoy the moment of driving and listening to music without being chased by events.
Well, and I think it gets back to the joy of driving. I think you have to ask yourself that part of the reason autonomous driving is of so much interest is that people are basically saying there are things I'd rather do than be behind the wheel of my automobile.
And in rush hour traffic.
In rush hour
traffic.
Going
back to what Gotti said, though, is on a beautiful open country road with the top down, if you have a convertible, it's awesome.
You don't text there.
No.
That's for sure. I could guarantee you that.
And this isn't a problem just for drivers. I mean, we in the work that we did with John, we talked about the number of pedestrians that are, you know, they're walking and texting or talking. And we actually cite a statistic that talked about the number of pedestrians that have shown up in hospital emergency rooms due to text, cell phone text-related accidents or injuries has increased, I think, 300% in recent years.
Yeah, and our other data point that from our research from last week that we just fielded is 78% of Americans would give up sex before their smartphone, which is an indictment on something. I'm not going to go.
No wonder this country is all messed up, right? We've got our priorities wrong. Yeah, very interesting. Is this taking over our lives completely then?
I think that's what we're saying. I mean, I think that for every trend, there's going to be an opposite trend. And I think we're seeing a lot of that in our work. You know, you see the rise of a company like Etsy, something like well over $3 billion in sales, which is about handcrafted goods in a very organic sort of physical marketplace. I think that's exactly.
So there is this conflicting messages here. So people are amazingly, viscerally connected to their mobile phone and through that to the digital world. But they're hearkening on yesterday's craft and the one they want to have their own little tchotchke that they did and they want to sell it and want to share it. it's less about making money out of it as to say, hey, I can do it. And these are two powerful elements that for me are an amazing opportunity for design. How we create meaningful, personable objects that are still delivering this digital experience, and sometimes, not always, sometimes.
So crafted, handcrafted, craftsmanship is exactly. going to play an element, even though it might be with a high-tech object.
Ability to customize, personalize, craft your experience, which, by the way, the car industry is way better than the tech industry, way better. About 25% of the car is more or less your own selected options, both on utility, like, you know, engine and so on, but also on color, you know, type of seats and so on. But again, I see that as a great opportunity.
Yeah. With that, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap this conversation up. I could listen to you guys all day long, but I want to thank you all for having come on AutoLine this week with me today, including Cheryl Connolly from the Ford Motor Company, Gadi Amit from New Deal Design, John Gerzema from BAV Consulting. It's been awesome talking to the three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.